out right now one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. Well, all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, up flown through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we're once again featuring two selections from Stephen D. Price's edited volume, Great American Western Short Stories. This is from Lions Press Classics. Our first story is entitled The Coming of Cassidy by Clarence E. Mulford. Generations of readers and viewers grew up with Hopalong Cassidy, beginning with his appearance in Pulp Fiction and then in the movies, and a television series that is still shown on cable channels. However, unlike the squeaky, clean-cut, heroic figure portrayed by actor William Boyd, riding a snow-white steed named Topper, the original Hopalong was a ranch hand cowboy who saw no reason to rely on judicial process when he could right wrongs his own way. This chapter of the 1908 novel Hopalong's Hop describes how he acquired his nickname. Having sent Jimmy to the Bar 20 with a message for Buck Peters and seen the Tenderfeet start for Sharpsville on the right trail and under escort, Bill Cassidy set out for the Crazy M Ranch by the way of Clay Gulch. He was to report on the condition of some cattle. Buck had been offered them cheap, and he was anxious to get back to the ranch. It was in the early evening when he reached Clay Gulch and rode slowly down the dusty, shack-lined street in search of a hotel. The town and the street were hardly different from other towns and streets that he had seen all over the cow country, but nevertheless he felt uneasy. The air seemed to be charged with danger, and it caused him to sit even more erect in the saddle and assume his habit of indifferent alertness. The first man he saw confirmed the feeling by staring at him insolently and sneering in a veiled way at the low-hung, tied-down holsters that graced Bill's thighs. The guns proclaimed the gunman as surely as it would have been proclaimed by a sign. And it appeared that gunmen were not at that time held in high esteem by the citizens of Clay Gulch. Bill was growing fretful and peevish when the man, with a knowing shake of his head, turned away and entered the harness shop. "Trouble's brewin' somewheres around," muttered Bill, and he went on. He had singled out the first of two hotels when another citizen, turning the corner, stopped in his tracks and looked Bill over with a deliberate scrutiny that left but little to the imagination. He frowned and started away, but Bill spurred forward, determined to make him speak. "Might I inquire if this is Clay Gulch?" he asked in tones that made the other wince. "You might," was the reply. "It is," added the citizen, "and the Crazy M lays 15 miles west." Having complied with the requirements of common politeness, the citizen of Clay Gulch turned and walked into the nearest saloon. Bill squinted after him and shook his head in indecision. "He wasn't guessing neither. He sure knowed where I wants to go. I reckon Oleson must have said he was expecting me." He would have been somewhat surprised had he known that Mr. Oleson, foreman of the Crazy M, had said nothing to anyone about the expected visitor, and that no one, not even on the ranch, knew of it. Mr. Oleson was blessed with taciturnity to a remarkable degree, and he had given up expecting to see anyone from Mr. Peters. As Bill dismounted in front of the Victoria, he noticed that two men further down the street had evidently changed their conversation and were examining him with frank interest and discussing him earnestly. As a matter of fact, they had not changed the subject of their conversation, but it simply fitted him in the place of a certain unknown. Before he had arrived, they discussed in the abstract. Now they could talk in the concrete. One of them laughed and called softly over his shoulder, whereupon a third man appeared in the door, wiping his lips with the back of a hairy, grimy hand, and focused evil eyes upon the innocent stranger. He grunted contemptuously and, turning on his heel, went back to his liquid pleasures. Bill covertly felt of his clothes and stole a glance at his horse, and could see nothing wrong. He hesitated, should he saunter over for information, or wait until the matter was brought to his attention. A sound inside the hotel made him choose the latter course, for his stomach threatened to become estranged, and it simply howled for food. Pushing open the door, he dropped his saddle in a corner and leaned against the bar. "Have one with me to get acquainted," he invited. "Then I'll eat, for I'm hungry, and I'll use one of your beds tonight, too." The man behind the bar nodded cheerfully and poured out his drink. As he raised the liquor, he noticed Bill's guns and carelessly let the glass return to the bar. "Sorry, sir," he said coldly. "I'm haul out of grub. The fire's hout. And the beds are taken. But maybe Ollie, down the strite, can take care of you." Bill was looking at him with an expression that said much, and he slowly extended his arm and pointed to the untasted liquor. "Always finish what you start, English," he said slowly and clearly. "When a man goes to take a drink with me and suddenly changes his mind, why, I gets riled. I don't know what ails this town, and I don't care. I don't give a cuss about your grub and your beds. But if you don't drink that liquor you poured out to drink, why, I'll naturally shove it down your British throat so cuss it hard it'll strain your neck. Get to it." The proprietor glanced apprehensively from the glass to Bill, then on to the businesslike guns and back to the glass, and the liquor disappeared at a gulp. "Why," he exclaimed, aggrieved, "there ain't no call for to get riled up like that, stranger. I bloody well forgot it." "Then don't you go and bloody well forget this. The next time I drops in here for grub and bed, you have 'em both, and be plumb polite about it. Do you get me?" he demanded icily. The proprietor stared at the angry puncher as he gathered up his saddle and rifle and started for the door. He turned to put away the bottle, and the sound came near being unfortunate for him. Bill leaped sideways, turning while in the air, and landed on his feet like a cat, his left hand gripping a heavy Colt that covered the short ribs of the frightened proprietor before that worthy could hardly realize the move. "Oh, all right," growled Bill, appearing to be disappointed. "I reckon maybe you was gambling on a sure thing. I feels impelled to offer you my sincere apology. You ain't the kind as would even gamble on a sure thing. You'll see me again," he promised. The sound of his steps on the porch ended in a thud as he leaped to the ground, and then he passed the window leading his horse and scowling darkly. The proprietor mopped his head and reached twice for the glass before he found it. "God, what a bloody even," he grunted. "He won't be as easy as the lost one, blime him." Mr. Hawley looked up and frowned, but there was something in the suspicious eyes that searched his face that made him cautious. Bill dropped his load on the floor and spoke sharply. "I want supper and a bed. You ain't full up, and you ain't out of grub, so I'm going to get 'em both right here. Yes?" "You sure called the turn, stranger," replied Mr. Hawley in his Sunday voice. "That's what I'm in business for, and business is sure dull these days." He wondered at the sudden smile that illuminated Bill's face and half guessed it, but he said nothing and went to work. When Bill pushed back from the table, he was more at peace with the world, and he treated, closely watching his companion. Mr. Hawley drank with a show of pleasure and forthwith brought out cigars. He seated himself beside his guest and sighed with relief. "I'm plumb tired out," he offered, "and I ain't done much. You look tired, too. Come a long way?" "Logan," replied Bill. "Do you know where I'm going, and why?" Mr. Hawley looked surprised and almost answered the first part of the question correctly before he thought. "Well," he grinned, "if I could tell where strangers was going and why, I wouldn't never ask 'em where they come from, and I'd sure hunt up a little game of faro, you bet." Bill smiled. "Well, that might be a good idea. But say, what ails this town, anyway?" "What ails it? Why, lack of money for one thing, scenery for another, women for another. Oh, hell, I ain't got time to tell you what ails it. Why? Is there anything the matter with me? I don't know you well enough for to answer that one correct. Well, would you turn around and stare at me and seem pained and hurt? Do I look funny? Has anybody put a sign on my back? You looks all right to me. What's the matter? Nothing yet, reflected Bill slowly. But there will be, maybe. You was mentioning Pharaoh. Here's a turn you can call. Somebody in this ward of a two-by-nothing town is going to run plumb into a big surprise. There'll maybe be a loud noise and some smoke where it starts from, and a little round hole where it stops. When the curious delegation now holding forth on the street slips in here after I'm in bed and makes inquiries about me, you can tell them that. And if Mr. Victoria drops in casual, tell him I'm cleaning my guns. Now then, show me where I'm going to sleep. Mr. Hawley very carefully led the way into the hall and turned into a room opposite the bar. Here she is, stranger, he said, stepping back. But Bill was out in the hall listening. He looked into the room and felt oppressed. No, she ain't, he answered, backing his intuition. She's upstairs, where there's a little breeze. By the Lord, he muttered under his breath, this is some puzzle. He mounted the stairs, shaking his head thoughtfully. It sure is, it sure is. The next morning, when Bill whirled up to the crazy bunkhouse and dismounted before the door, a puncher was emerging. He started to say something, noticed Bill's guns, and went on without a word. Bill turned around and looked after him in amazement. Well, what the devil, he growled. Before he could do anything, had he wished to, Mr. Oleson stepped quickly from the house, nodded and hurried toward the ranch house, motioning for Bill to follow. Entering the house, the foreman of the Crazy M waited impatiently for Bill to get inside and then hurriedly closed the door. They've got onto it some way, he said, his taciturnity gone, but that don't make no difference if you've got the sand. I'll pay you $150 a month, furnish your cayuses, and feed you. I'm losing more than 200 cows every month and can't get a trace of the thieves. Harris, Marshal of Clay Gulch, is stumped too. He can't move without proof. You can. The first man to get is George Thomas, then his brother Art. By that time you'll know how things lay. George Thomas is keeping out of Harris's way. He killed a man last week over in Tuxedo, and Harris wants to take him over there. He'll not help you, so don't ask him to. Before Bill could reply or recover from his astonishment, Oleson continued and described several men. Look out for ambushes. It'll be the hardest game you ever went up again. And if you ain't got the sand to go through with it, say so. Bill shook his head. I got the sand to go through with anything I starts, but I don't start here. I reckon you got the wrong man. I come up here to look over a herd for Buck Peters, and here you go shoving wages like that at me. When I tells Buck what I've been offered, he'll fall dead. He laughed. Now I know the answer to a lot of things. Hear, hear, he exclaimed as Oleson began to rave. Don't you get all head up like that. I reckon I can keep my face shut. And let me observe in your hat-like ear that if the rest of this gang is like the samples I seen in town, a good gunman would sure be robbing you to take all that money for the job. 50 a month for 2 months would be plenty. Oleson's dismay was fading, and he accepted the situation with a grim smile. You don't know them fellers, he replied. They're a bad lot, and won't stop at nothing. All right, let's take a look at them cows. I want to get home soon as I can. Oleson shook his head. I gave you up. And when I got a better offer, I let him go. I'm sorry you had to ride for nothing, but I couldn't get word to you. Bill led the way in silence back to the bunkhouse and mounted his horse. All right, he nodded. I sure was late. Well, I'll be going. That gunman is late, too, said Oleson. Maybe he ain't coming. You want the job at my figures? Nope. I got a better job, though it don't pay so much money. It's steady and a hull of a lot cleaner. So long, and Bill loped away, closely watched by Shorty Allen from the corral. After an interval, Shorty mounted and swung out of the other gate of the corral and rode along the bottom of an arroyo until he felt it was safe to follow Bill's trail. When Shorty turned back, he was almost to town, and he would not have been pleased had he known that Bill knew of the trailing for the last 10 miles. Bill had doubled back and was within 100 yards of Shorty when that person turned ranchward. "Huh, I must be popular," grunted Bill. "I reckon I will stay in Clay Gulch till tomorrow morning, and at the Victoria," he grinned. Then he laughed heartily. "Victoria, I got a better name for it than that, all right." When he pulled up before the Victoria and looked in, the proprietor was scowling at him, which made Bill frown as he went on to Holly's. Putting his horse in the corral, he carried his saddle and rifle into the barroom and looked around. There was no one in sight, and he smiled. Putting the saddle and rifle back in one corner under the bar and covering them with gunny sacks, he strolled over to the Victoria and entered through the rear door. The proprietor reached for his gun, but reconsidered in time and picked up a glass, which he polished with exaggerated care. There was something about the stranger that obtruded upon his peace of mind and confidence. He would let someone else try the stranger out. Bill walked slowly forward, by force of will ironing out the humor in his face and assuming his sternest expression. "I want supper and a bed, and don't forget to be plumb polite," he rumbled, sitting down by the side of a small table in such a manner that it did not in the least interfere with the movement of his right hand. The observing proprietor observed and gave strict attention to the preparation of the meal. The gunman, glancing around, slowly arose and walked carelessly to a chair that had blank wall behind it and from where he could watch windows and doors. When the meal was placed before him, he glanced up. "Go over there and sit down," he ordered, motioning to a chair that stood close to the rifle that leaned against the wall. "Loaded?" he demanded. The proprietor could only nod. "Then sling it across your knees and keep still. Well, start moving." The proprietor walked as though he were in a trance, but when he seated himself and reached for the weapon, a sudden flash of understanding illumined him and caused cold sweat to bead upon his wrinkled brow. He put the weapon down again, but the noise made Bill look up. "Across your knees," growled the puncher, and the proprietor hastily obeyed, but when it touched his legs, he let loose of it as though it were hot. He felt a great awe steal through his fear, for here was a gunman such as he had read about. This man gave him all the best of it just to tempt him to make a break. The rifle had been in his hands, and while it was there, the gunman was calmly eating with both hands on the table, and had not even looked up until the noise of the gun made him. "My God, he must be a wizard with him. I hopes I don't forget." With the thought came a great itching of his kneecap. Then his foot itched so as to make him squirm and wear horrible expressions. Bill, glancing up carelessly, caught sight of the expressions and growled, whereupon they became angelic. Fearing that he could no longer hold in the laughter that tortured him, Bill arose. "Shoulder arms," he ordered crisply. The gun went up with trained precision. "Been a soldier," thought Bill. "Carry arms, about face, to a bedroom, march." He followed, holding his sides, and stopped before the room. "This the best?" he demanded. "Well, it ain't good enough for me. About face, forward, march, column, left, ground, arms, fall out." Tossing a coin on the floor as payment for the supper, Bill turned sharply and went out without even a backward glance. The proprietor wiped the perspiration from his face and walked unsteadily to the bar, where he poured out a generous drink and gulped it down. Peering out of the door to see if the coast was clear, he scurried across the street and told his troubles to the harness maker. Bill leaned weakly against Holly's and laughed until the tears rolled down his cheeks. Pushing weakly from the building, he returned to the Victoria to play another joke on its proprietor. Finding it vacant, he slipped upstairs and hunted for a room to suit him. The bed was the softest he had seen for a long time, and it lured him into removing his boots and chaps and guns, after he had propped a chair against the door as a warning signal. and stretching out flat on his back, he prepared to enjoy solid comfort. It was not yet dark, and he was not sleepy. He lay there thinking over the events of the past 24 hours, often laughing so hard as to shake the bed. What a reputation he would have in the morning! The softness of the bed got in its work, and he fell asleep, for how long he did not know. But when he awakened, it was dark, and he heard voices coming up from below. They came from the room he had refused to take. One expression banished all thoughts of sleep from his mind, and he listened intently. Red-headed Irish gunman. Why, they means me. Make him hop into hell. I don't reckon I'd do that for anybody, even my friends. I tried to give him this room, but he wouldn't take it, protested the proprietor hurriedly. He says the bloody room wasn't good enough for him, and he marches me out and makes off. Likely he's at Ollie's. No, he ain't, growled a strange voice. You've gone and bungled the whole thing. But I saw I didn't, you know. I tries to give him this very room, George, but he wouldn't have it. Do you think I wants him running around this bloomin' town? He's worse nor the other, and God knows he was bad enough. He's a cold-blooded beggar, he is. You missed your chance, grunted the other. Wish Z had that gun you had. I was wishing to God you did, retorted the proprietor. It never looked so bloody big before, damn his eyed. Well, this cayuse is in Holly's corral, said the first speaker. If I ever find Holly kept him under cover, I'll blow his head off. Come on, we'll get Harris first. He ought to be getting close to town if he got the word I sent over to Tuxedo. He won't let us call him. He's a man of his word. He'll be here all right. Fred and Tom is watching his shack, and we better take the other into town. There's no telling how he'll come in now, suggested Art Thomas. But I wish I'd knowed where that cussed gunman is. As they went out, Bill, his chaps on and his boots in his hand, crept down the stairs and stopped as he neared the hall door. The proprietor was coming back. The others were outside, going to their stations, and did not hear the choking gasp that the proprietor made as a pair of strong hands reached out and throttled him. When he came to, he was lying face down on a bed, gagged and bound by a rope that cut into his wrists. Bill, waiting a moment, slipped into the darkness and was swallowed up. He was looking for Mr. Harris and looking eagerly. The moon arose and bathed the dusty street and its crude shacks in silver, cunningly and charitably hiding its ugliness, and passed on as the skirmishing rays of the sun burst into the sky in close and eternal pursuit. As the dawn spread swiftly and long, thin shadows sprang across the sandy street. There arose from the dissipated darkness close to the wall of a building an armed man, weary and slow from a tiresome vigil. Another emerged from behind a pile of boards that faced the marshal's abode, while down the street another crept over the edge of a dried-out watercourse and swore softly as he stood up slowly to flex away the stiffness of cramped limbs. Of vain speculation he was now empty. He had exhausted all the whys and hows long before, and now only muttered discontentedly as he reviewed the hours of fruitless waiting. And he was uneasy. It was not like Harris to take a dare and swallow his own threats without a struggle. He looked around apprehensively, shrugged his shoulders, and stalked behind the shacks across from the two hotels. Another figure crept from the protection of Holly's corral like a slinking coyote, gun in hand and nervously alert. He was just in time to escape the challenge that would have been hurled at him by Holly himself, had that gentleman seen the skulker as he grouchily opened one shutter and scowled sleepily at the kindling eastern sky. Mr. Holly was one of those who go to bed with regret and get up with remorse, and his temper was always easily disturbed before breakfast. The skulker, safe from the remorseful gentleman's eyes and gun, kept close to the building as he walked, and was again fortunate, for he had passed when Mr. Holly strode heavily into his kitchen to curse the cold, rusty stove, a rite he faithfully performed each morning. Across the street, George and Art Thomas walked to meet each other behind the row of shacks, and stopped near the harness shop to hold a consultation. The subject was so interesting that for a few minutes they were oblivious to all else. A man softly stepped to the door of the Victoria and watched the two cross the street with an expression on his face that showed his smiling contempt for them and their kind. He was a small man, so far as physical measurements go, but he was lithe, sinewy, and compact. On his open vest, hanging slovenly and blinkingly in the growing light as if to prepare itself for the blinding glare of midday, glinted a five-pointed star of nickel, a lowly badge that every rural community knows and holds in awe far above the metal or design. Swinging low on his hip gleamed the ivory butt of a silver-plated Colt, the one weakness that his vanity seized upon. But under the silver in its engraving, above and before the cracked and stained ivory handles, lay the power of a great force, and under the casing of the marshal's small body lay a virile manhood, strong in courage and determination. Toby Harris watched, smilingly. He loved the dramatic and found keen enjoyment in the situation. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a carelessly dressed cowpuncher slouching indolently along close to the buildings on the other side of the street with the misleading sluggishness of a panther. The red hair, kissed by the slanting rays of the sun where it showed beneath the soiled sombrero, seemed to be a flaming warning. The half-closed eyes, squinting under the brim of the big hat, missed nothing as they darted from point to point. The marshal stepped silently to the porch and then onto the ground, his back to the rear of the hotel, waiting to be discovered. He had been in sight perhaps a minute. The cowpuncher made a sudden, eye-baffling movement and smoke whirled about his hips. Fred, turning the corner behind the marshal, dropped his gun with a scream of pain and rage. He crashed against the window in sudden sickness, his gun hand hanging by a tendon from his wrist. The marshal stepped quickly forward at the shot and for an instant gazed deeply into the eyes of the startled rustlers. Then his Colt leaped out and crashed a fraction of a second before the brothers fired. George Thomas reeled, caught sight of the puncher, and fired by instinct. Bill, leaving Harris to watch the other side of the street, was watching the rear corner of the Victoria and was unprepared for the shot. He crumpled and dropped, and then the marshal, enraged, ended the rustler's earthly career in a stream of flame and smoke. Tom, turning into the street further down, wheeled and dashed for his horse, and Art, having leaped behind the harness shop, turned and fled for his life. He had nearly reached his horse and was going at top speed with great leaps when the prostrate man in the street, raising on his elbow, emptied his gun after him, the five shots sounding almost as one. Art Thomas arose convulsively, steadied himself, and managed to gain the saddle. Harris looked hastily down the street and saw a cloud of dust racing northward and grunted, "Let them go. They won't never come back no more." Running to the cowpuncher, he raised him after a hurried examination of the wounded thigh. "Hop along, Cassidy," he smiled in encouragement. "You'll be a better man with one good leg than the whole gang was all put together." The puncher smiled faintly as Holly, running to them, helped him toward his hotel. "The bone is plumb smashed. I reckon I'll hop along through life. I'll be Hop Along for me, all right. That's my name, all right. Huh, Hop Along Cassidy. But I didn't hop into it, did I, Harris?" He grinned bravely. And thus was born a nickname that found honor and fame in the cow country, a name that stood for loyalty, courage, and most amazing gunplay. I have Red's word for this and the endorsement of those who knew him at the time. And from this on, up to the time he died and after, we will forsake Bill and speak of him as Hopalong Cassidy, a cowpuncher who lived and worked in the days when the West was wild and rough and lawless, and who, like others, through the medium of the only court at hand, Judge Colt, enforced justice as he believed it should be enforced. That was The Coming of Cassidy by Clarence E. Mulford. Now we'll be reading The Rustler of Wind River by George W. Ogden. George W. Ogden was a Midwestern newspaperman whose career spanned the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries. He wrote more than 30 novels and many more pulp fiction stories, most of which were set in the Old West. Here, in The Rustler of Wind River, published in 1917, he painted a vivid picture of a feisty young woman and a realistic multicultural setting. Fort Shackey was on its downhill way in those days, and almost at the bottom of the decline. It was considered a post of penance by enlisted men and officers alike. Nested up there in the high plateau against the mountains in its place of wild beauty and picturesque charm. But natural beauty and Indian picturesqueness do not fill the place in the soldierly breast of fair civilian lady faces, nor torrential streams of cold mountain water supply the music of the locomotive's toot. Fort Shackey was being crept up upon by civilization, true, but was coming all too slow for the booted troopers and belted officers who must wear away the months in its lonely silences. Within the memory of officers not yet gray, the post had been 150 miles from a railroad. Now it was but 20, but even that short leap drowned the voice of the locomotive, and the dot at the rail's end held few of the endearments which make soldiering sweet. Soon the post must go, indeed, for the need of it had passed. The Shoshones, Arapahoes, and Crows had forgotten their old animosities, and were traveling with Buffalo Bill, going to college and raising alfalfa under the direction of a government farmer. The Indian police were in training to do the soldiers' work here. Soon the post must stand abandoned, a lonely monument to the days of hard riding, long watches, and bleak years. Not a soldier in the service but prayed for the hastening of the day. No, there was not much overt meander at the railroad's end to cheer a soldier's heart. It was an inspiring ride in these autumn days to come to meander, past the little brimming lakes, which seemed to lie without banks in the green meadows where wild elk fed with the shy Indian cattle, over the white hills where the earth gave under the hoofs like new fallen snow. But when one came to it through the expanding dusty miles, the reward of his long ride was not in keeping with his effort. Certainly, privates and subalterns could get drunk there as speedily as in the centers of refinement, but there were no gentlemanly diversions at which an officer could dispel the gloom of his sour days in garrison. The rough-cheeked girls of that high-wind country were well enough for cowboys to swing in their wild dances, just a rung above the squaws on the reservation in the matter of loquacity, hardly the sort for a man who had the memory of white gloves and gleaming shoulders and the traditions of the service to maintain. Of course, there was the exception of Nola Chadron, but she was not of meander in the railroad's end, and she only came in flashes of summer brightness, like a swift, gay bird. But when Nola was at the ranch house on the river, the gloom lifted over the post, and the sour leaven in the hearts of unmarried officers became as sweet as manna in the cheer of the unusual social outlet thus provided. Nola kept the big house in a blaze of joy while she nested there through the summer days. The 16 miles which stretched between it and the post ran out like a silver band before those who rode into the smile of her welcome, and when she flitted away to Cheyenne, champagne and silk hats in the autumn, a grayness hovered again over the military post in the corner of the reservation. Later than usual, Nola had lingered on this fall, and the social outlet had remained open, like a navigable river over which the thread of ice hung, but had not yet fallen. There were not lacking those who held that the lodestone which kept her there at the ranch house, when the gaieties of the season beckoned elsewhere, was in the breast of Major Cuvier King. Fatal infatuation, said the married ladies at the post, knowing, as everybody knew in the service, that Major King was betrothed to Frances Landcraft, the colonel's daughter. No matter for any complications which might come of it, Nola had remained on, and the major had smiled on her and ridden with her and cut high capers in the dance, all pending the return of Frances and her mother from their summering at Bar Harbor, in compliance with the family traditions. Now Frances was back again, and fortune had thrown a sunburst of beauty into the post by centering her and Nola here at once. Nola was the guest of the colonel's daughter, and there were flutterings in uniformed breasts. Beef Day was an event at the agency which never grew old to the people at the post. Without Beef Day, they must have dwindled off to acidulous shadows, as the Indians who depended upon it for more solid sustenance would have done in the event of its discontinuation by a paternal government. There were phases of Indian life and character which one never saw save on Beef Day, which fell on Wednesday of each week. Guests at the post watched the bright picture with the keen interest of a pageant on the stage. Tourists came over by stage from Meander in the summer months by the score to be present. The resident officers and their wives and families, such as had them, found in it a never recurring source of interest and relief from the tedium of days all alike. This Beef Day, the morning following the meeting between Saul Shadron and his mysterious guest, a chattering group stood on the veranda of Colonel Landcraft's house in the bright, friendly sun. They were waiting for horses to make the short journey to the agency, for one's honesty was questioned, his sanity doubted, if he went afoot in that country even a quarter of a mile. The gayest among them was Nola Shadron, the sun in her fair, springing hair. Nola's crown reached little higher than a proper soldier's heart, but what she lacked in stature she supplied in plastic perfection of body and vivacity of face. There was a bounding joyousness of life in her, her eager eyes reflecting only the anticipated pleasures of today. There was no shadow of yesterday's regret in them, no cloud of tomorrow's doubt. On the other balance, there was Frances Landcraft, taller by half a head, soldierly, too, as became her lineage, in the manner of lifting her chin in what seemed a patrician scorn of small things, such as a lady should walk the world unconscious of. The brown in her hair was richer than the clear agate of her eyes. It rippled across her ear like the scroll of water upon the sand. There was a womanly dignity about her, although the threshold of girlhood must not have been far behind her that bright autumnal morning. Her nod was equal to a stave of Nola's chatter, her smile worth a league of the light laughter from that bounding little lady's lips. Not that she was always so silent as on that morning, there among the young wives of the post, at her own guest's side. She had her hours of overflowing spirits like any girl, but in some company she was always grave. When Major King was in attendance especially, the seeing ones made note, and there were others too who said that she was by nature a colonel among women, haughty, cold, and aloof. These wondered how the Major ever had made headway with her up to the point of gaining her hand. Knowing ones smiled at that, and said it had been arranged. There were ambitions on both sides of that match, it was known. Ambition on the Colonel's part to secure his only child a station of dignity, and what he held to be of consequence above all achievements in the world. Major King was a rising man, with two friends in the cabinet. It was said that he would be a brigadier general before he reached 40. On the Major's side was the ambition to strengthen his political affiliations by alliance with a family of patrician strain, together with the money that his bride would bring. For Colonel Landcraft was a weighty man in this world's valued accumulations, so the match had been arranged. The veranda of the colonel's house gave a view of the parade grounds and the long avenue that came down between the officers' houses, cottonwoods lacing their limbs above the road. There was green in the lawns, the flash of flowers between the leaves and shrubs, white gleaming walls, trim walks, shorn hedges. It seemed a pleasant place of quiet beauty that bright September morning, and a pity to give it up by and by to dust and desolation. A place where men and women might be happy, but for the gnawing fire of ambition in their hearts. Mrs. Colonel Landcraft was not going. Indians made her sick, she said, especially Indians sitting around in the tall grass waiting for the carcasses to be cut up and apportioned out to them in bloody chunks. But there seemed to be another source of her sickness that morning, measuring by the grave glances with which she searched her daughter's face. She wondered whether the Major and Frances had quarreled, and if so, whether Nola Shadron had been the cause. They were off, with the Colonel and a lately assigned captain in the lead. there was a keener pleasure in this beef day than usual for the colonel, for he had new ground to sow with its wonders, which were beginning to pale in his old eyes, which had seen so much of the world. "Very likely we'll see the minister's wife there," said he, as they rode forward, "and if so, it will be worth your while to take special note of her. St. John Matthews, the Episcopalian minister over there at the mission, those white buildings there among the trees, is a full-blooded Crow. One of the pioneer missionaries took him up and sent him back east to school, where in time he entered the ministry and married this white girl. She was a college girl, I've been told, glamored by the romance of Matthews' life. Well, it was soon over." The colonel sighed and fell silent. The captain, feeling that it was intended that he should, made polite inquiry. "The trouble is that Matthews is an Indian out of his place," the colonel resumed. "He returned here 20 years or so ago and took up his work among his people, but as he advanced toward civilization, his wife began to slip back. Little by little, she adopted the Indian ways and dress. Until now, you couldn't tell her from a squaw if you were to meet her for the first time. She presents a curious psychological study, or perhaps biological example of atavism, for I believe there's more body than soul in the poor creature now. It's nature maintaining the balance, you see. He goes up, she slips back. If she's there, she'll be squatting among the squaws, waiting to carry home her husband's allotment of warm, bloody beef. She doesn't have to do it, and it shames and humiliates Matthews, too, even though they say she cuts it up and divides it among the poorer Indians. She's a savage. Her eyes sparkle at the sight of red meat." They rounded the agency buildings and came upon an open meadow in which the slaughterhouses stood at a distance from the road. Here in the grassy expanse the Indians were gathered, waiting the distribution of the meat. The scene was barbarically animated. Groups of women in their bright dresses sat here and there on the grass, and apart from them in gravity waited old men in moccasins and blankets with feathers in their hair. Spry young men smoked cigarettes and talked volubly, garbed in the worst of civilization and the most useless of savagery. One and all, they turned their backs upon the visitors, the nearest troops and individuals moving away from them with the impassive dignity of their race. There is more scorn in an Indian squaw's back turned to an impertinent stranger than in the faces of 6 matrons of society's finest sifted under similar conditions. Colonel Landcraft led his party across the meadow, entirely unconscious of the cold disdain of the people whom he looked down upon from his superior heights. He could not have understood if any there had felt the trespass from the Indian side, and there was one, very near and dear to the colonel, who felt it so and attempted to explain. The colonel very likely would have puffed up with military consequence almost to the bursting point. Feeling, delicacy, and those smeared, smelling creatures? Surliness in excess they might have, but dignity not at all. Were they not there as beggars to receive bounty from the government's hand? "Oh, there's Mrs. Matthews," said Nola, with the eagerness of a child who has found a quail's nest in the grass. She was off at an angle, like a hunter on the scent. Colonel Landcraft and his guest followed with equal rude eagerness, and the others swept after them, Francis alone hanging back. Major King was at Nola's side. If he noted the legging of his fiancée, he did not heed. The minister's wife, a shawl over her head, her braided hair in front of her shoulders like an Indian woman, rose from her place in startled confusion. She looked as if she would have fled if an avenue had been open or a refuge presented. The embarrassed creature was obliged to stand in their curious eyes and stammer in a tongue which seemed to be growing strange to her from its uncommon use. She was a short woman, growing heavy and shapeless now, and there was a gray in her black hair. Her skin was browned by sun, wind, and smoke to the hue of her poor neighbors and friends. When she spoke in reply to the questions which poured upon her, she bent her head like a timid girl. Frances checked her horse and remained behind, out of range of hearing. She was cut to the heart with shame for her companions, and her cheek burned with the indignation that she suffered with the harried women in their midst. A little Indian girl came flying past, ducking and dashing under the neck of Francis's horse, in pursuit of a piece of paper which the wind whirled ahead of her. At Francis's stirrup she caught it and held it with a smile. "Did you lose this, lady?" she asked in the very best of mission English. "No," said Francis, bending over to see what it might be. The little girl placed it in her hand and scurried away to a beckoning woman who stood on her knees and scowled over her offspring's dash into the ways of civilized little girls. It was a narrow strip of paper that she had rescued from the wind, with the names of several men written on it in pencil, at the head of the list the name of Alan MacDonald. Opposite that name, some crude hand had entered, with pen that had flowed heavily under his pressure, the figures $500. Francis turned it round her finger and sat waiting for the others to leave off their persecution of the minister's wife and come back to her, wondering in abstracted wandering of mind who Alan MacDonald might be, and for what purpose he had subscribed the sum of $500. "I think she's the most romantic little thing in the world," Nola was declaring, in her extravagant surface way as they returned to where Francis sat her horse, her wandering eyes on the blue foothills, the strip of paper prominent about her finger. "Oh, honey, what's the matter? Did you cut your finger?" "No," said Francis, her serious young face lighting with a smile. "It's a little subscription list or something that somebody lost. Alan MacDonald heads it for $500. Do you know Alan MacDonald and what his charitable purpose may be?" Nola tossed her head with a contemptuous sniff. "They call him the King of Rustlers up the river," said she. "Oh, he is a man of consequence, then," said Frances, a quickening of humor in her brown eyes, seeing that Nola was up on her high horse about it. "We'd better be going down to the slaughterhouse if we want to see the fun," bustled the colonel, wheeling his horse. "I see a movement setting in that way." "He's just a common thief," declared Nola with flushed cheek and resentful eye, as Francis fell in beside her for the march against the abattoir. Francis still carried the paper twisted about her finger, reserving her judgment upon Alan MacDonald, for she knew something of the feuds of that hard-speaking land. "Anyway, I suppose he'd like to have his paper back," she suggested. "Will you hand it to him the next time you meet him?" Francis was entirely grave about it, although it was only a piece of banter which she felt that Nola would appreciate. But Nola was not in an appreciative mood, for she was a full-blooded daughter of the baronial rule. She jerked her head like a vicious bronco and reined hurriedly away from Francis as she extended the paper. "I'll not touch the thing," said Nola, fire in her eyes. Major King was enjoying the passage between the girls, riding at Nola's side with his cavalry hands held precisely. "If I'm not mistaken, the gentleman in question is there talking to Miller, the agent," said he, nodding toward two horsemen a little distance ahead. "But I wouldn't excite him, Miss Lancraft, if I were you. He's said to be the quickest and deadliest man with a weapon on this range." Major King smiled over his own pleasantry. Francis looked at Nola with brows lifted inquiringly as if waiting her verification. Then the grave young lady settled back in her saddle and laughed merrily, reaching across and touching her friend's arm in a conciliating caress. "Oh, you delightful little savage," she said. "I believe you'd like to take a shot at poor Mr. MacDonald yourself." "We never start anything on the reservation," Nola rejoined, quite seriously. Miller, the Indian agent, rode away and left MacDonald sitting there on his horse as the military party approached. He spurred up to meet the colonel and to present his respects to the ladies, a hard matter for a little round man with a tight paunch sitting in a Mexican saddle. The party halted, and Francis looked across at MacDonald, who seemed to be waiting for Miller to rejoin him. MacDonald was a supple, sinewy man as he appeared across the few rods intervening. His coat was tied with his slicker at the cantle of his saddle. His blue flannel shirt was powdered with the white dust of the plain. Instead of the flaring neckerchief which most cowboys commonly favored, MacDonald wore a cravat, the ends of it tucked into the bosom of his shirt, and in place of the leather chaps of men who ride breakneck through brush and bramble, his legs were clad in tough brown corduroys, and fended by boots to his knees. There were revolvers in the holsters at his belt. Not an unusual figure for that time and place, but something uncommon in the air of unbending severity that sat on him, which Francis felt even at that distance. He looked like a man who had a purpose in his life, and who was living it in his own brave way. If he was a cattle thief, as they charged, thought she, then she would put her faith against the world that he was indeed a master of his trade. They were talking around Miller, who was going to give them places of vantage for the coming show. Only Francis and Major King were left behind, for she had stopped her horse to look curiously across at Alan MacDonald, King of the Rustlers, as he was called. "It may not be anything at all to him, and it may be something important," said Francis, reaching out the slip to Major King. "Would you mind handing it to him and explaining how it came into my hands?" "I'll not have anything to do with the fellow," said the Major, flushing hotly. "How can you ask such a thing of me? Throw it away. It's no concern of yours, the memorandum of a cattle thief." Frances drew herself straight. Her imperious chin was as high as Major King had ever carried his own in the most self-conscious moment of his military career. "Will you take it to him?" she demanded. "Certainly not," returned the Major, haughtily emphatic. Then, softening a little, "Don't be silly, Francis. What a row you make over a scrap of blowing paper." "Then I'll take it myself." "Miss Lancraft!" "Major King!" It was the steel of conventionality against the flint of womanly defiance. Major King started in his saddle as if to reach out and restrain her. It was one of those defiantly foolish little things which women and men, especially women, do in moments of pique, and Frances knew it at the time. But she rode away from the Major with a hot flush of insubordination in her cheeks, and Alan MacDonald quickened from his pensive pose when he saw her coming. His hand went to his hat when her intention became unmistakable to him. She held the little paper out toward him while still a rod away. "A little Indian girl gave me this. She found it blowing along. They tell me you were Mr. MacDonald," she said, her face as serious as his own. "I thought it might be a subscription list for the church, or something, and that you might want it." "Thank you, Miss Lancraft," said he, his voice low modulated, his manner easy. Her face colored at the unexpected way of this man without a coat, who spoke her name with the accent of refinement, just as if he had known her and had met her casually upon the way. "I have seen you 100 times at the post and the agency," he explained, to smooth away her confusion. "I have seen you from afar." "Oh," said she, as lame as the word was short. He was scanning the written paper. Now he looked at her, a smile waking in his eyes. It moved in slow illumination over his face, but did not break his lips, pressed in their stern, strong line. She saw that his long hair was light and that his eyes were gray, with sandy brows over them which stood on end at the points nearest his nose, from a habit of bending them in concentration, she supposed, as he had been doing but a moment before he smiled. "No, it isn't a church subscription, Miss Lancraft. It's for a cemetery," said he. "Oh," said she again, wondering why she did not go back to Major King, whose horse appeared restive and in need of the spur, which the Major gave him unfeelingly. At the same time she noted that Alan MacDonald's forehead was broad and deep, for his leather-weighted hat was pushed back from it where his fair, straight hair lay thick, and that his bony chin had a little croft in it, and that his face was long and hollowed like a student's, and that youth was in his eyes in spite of the experience which hardships of unknown kind had written across his face. Not a handsome man, but a strong one in his way, whatever that way might be. "I'm indebted to you for this," said he, drawing forth his watch with a quick movement as he spoke, opening the back cover, folding the little paper carefully away in it, and grateful beyond words. "Goodbye, Mr. MacDonald," said she, wheeling her horse suddenly, smiling back at him as she rode away to Major King. Alan MacDonald sat with his hat off until she was again at the major's side, when he replaced it over his fair hair with slow hand, as if he had come away from some holy presence. As for Frances, her turn of defiance had driven her clouds away. She met the major smiling and radiant, a twinkling of mischief in her lively eyes. The major was a diplomat, as all good soldiers, and some very indifferent ones, are. Whatever his dignity and gentler feelings had suffered while she was away, he covered the hurt now with a smile. "And how fares the bandit king this morning?" he inquired. "He seems to be in spirits," she replied. The others were out of sight around the buildings where the carcasses of beef had been prepared. Nobody but the major knew of Francis's little dash out of the conventional, and the knowledge that it was so was comfortable in his breast. "And the papers," said he, in melodramatic whisper, "were they the thieves' muster roll?" "He isn't a thief," said she, with quiet dignity. "He's a gentleman. Yes, the paper was important." "Ah, the plot deepens," said Major King. "It was a matter of life and death," said she, with solemn rebuke for his levity, speaking a truer word than she was aware. And thus concludes The Rustler of Wind River by George W. Ogden. I hope that you have enjoyed these two Western short stories from Great American Western Short Stories, edited by Stephen D. Price. And this has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cowboys he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky. And up the cloudy draw, hi-yay, yippee-i-ho.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
HEB, in partnership with Favor Delivery, started Friday a service that gives seniors access to a personal shopper by phone, allowing them to get essential food and supplies delivered to them while remaining in the comfort and safety of their home. Times are 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., 7 days a week. To access the senior support line, call 1-833-397-0080. Again, that number is 1-833-397-0080. To find out more about the program, visit favordelivery.com/senior.
Starting Thursday on the Noon Book Hour, we begin The Puppy That Came for Christmas, How a Dog Brought One Family the Gift of Joy by Megan Ricks. All Megan Ricks ever wanted was a baby, yet month after month, Megan's dreams were dashed. Would her life ever feel complete? Megan and her husband Ian found a surprising answer when they began training golden retriever pups to become service dogs for people with disabilities, but opening their homes and hearts up to Emma and then Freddie, only to have each move on after 6 months, eventually took its own toll. Megan and Ian didn't know if they could continue. Then, one Christmas, little Traffy came along and stayed. An instant international bestseller, this book is a heartwarming and inspirational story that will captivate. The Puppy That Came for Christmas by Megan Ricks, starting Thursday at noon and Friday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 45 and clear. Tonight clear with a low in the mid-30s. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello again. This is Joni LaBeouf for the Georgia Radio Reading Service, continuing with Skipping Christmas by John Grisham. This is the fifth reading from this book, which was published in 2001 by Doubleday. If you remember last time, Blair is coming home for Christmas in just a few hours with a new fiancé, a doctor, and she expects Christmas. And so we continue. 2 hours. Nora had a watch, but from someone else the time sounded so awful. 2 hours. Oh, well, gotta run, she said. You're on Hemlock, he said.